That's a great song, isn't it? Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. My wife said I had to fix something. Well, we're already in Psalm 105. Seems like just yesterday we were in Psalm 1. It's definitely not been a jet tour, has it? But I tell you, I've really grown to appreciate and love the Psalms even more, and I trust every time we read it, it's just, it renews itself within our hearts and our minds and reveals just the necessity of praise and the power that there is in giving praise to God. In fact, this is why we've been called, to give glory, to give praise to God. What exactly does that look like? And we've been kind of following through in that vein. And just to take the most recent Psalms together, what I'd like for us to do is just to kind of move these three together, Psalm 103, Psalm 104, and now Psalm 105. If I were to summarize in some way the emphasis of Psalm 103, it would fundamentally be, you need to be all in. The statement within the passage at the very beginning of Psalm 103 is that I need to bless the Lord with all my soul, well, wait a minute, and all that is within me. Now, if you look with me in Psalm 103 and you see the very beginning of this, the way that he starts off, he begins to list the different things that happen to us and things that reveal the weaknesses of us. So if you look within the passage, it starts off, and once again, if you look at verse 2, bless the Lord, O my soul, and what's the next phrase? Don't forget anything. Which it's taken us into the realm of, you've got to be all in this. God is looking for those. I mean, what kind of praise is half-hearted praise? It's no praise at all. And what kind of praise would be praise in just certain scenarios or with certain situations? What kind of praise would that be? In other words, we become very selective in our praise. I'll give God thanks if I win $1 million today. But if difficult times come, then I'm not going to give him praise because I'm not happy about that. And things aren't working the way that I think that they should work, then I'm not going to be happy about that, then I'm not going to give him praise about that. Well, the passage begins to remind us that God brings things into our life to bring out praise in every area of our life. So if you look at the verse 3, who pardons all your iniquities, well, you should be giving God thanks for the fact that he forgives your sins. And then who pardons, who heals all your diseases. You know, why is it that I have to have suffering? Why is it that I have, you know, illness? Well, I don't know. Have you been giving God thanks for your health? No. Well, I get real sick, then watch him heal you, and you're going to be very thankful. You're going to be very thankful. Who redeems your life from the pit? Well, you had those close calls and, you know, the times in which depression seemed to almost overwhelm you. I mean, that really covers a gamut of things. Who literally redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with loving kindness and compassion, who satisfies your years with good things and renews your strength like an eagle. Well, bless the Lord, all my soul, everything that is within me. I mean, you're thanking God for the health. You're thanking God for your provisions. You're thanking God that you exist today. You're thanking God for almost every area you are, every area of your life. So the fundamental point of the psalm is that you have to do this all the way. And what God is looking for, I mean, it can't be true praise unless you're all in. And so Psalm 103 fundamentally establishes that. You're all in. And, of course, it ends within the passage, verse 22, bless the Lord, all you works of his, in all places of his dominion, bless the Lord, O my soul. The wonderful psalm that deals with all those areas and us coming all in. Now, when you come to Psalm 104, there seems to be a testing of through forces. Okay? God brings things into our lives. And you go, well, how does he do that? Well, he has all kinds of messengers. He has all kinds of powers. And he begins to list this at the very beginning of the psalm. So he talks about the fact that, well, at verse 3, he makes clouds his chariots, he walks upon the wings of the wind, he makes the wind his messengers, flaming fire his ministers. In other words, God is doing a work on the earth, and he is testing the hearts of men. And so, I mean, look, we know that many a man proclaims his loyalty, but a faithful man who can find, right? So a lot of people will say, you know, I am praising God. I am praising God. And God goes, we'll see. Because it's real easy to praise God, you know, when he sends forth, verse 10, when he sends forth springs of the valleys, they floated between the mountains, he gives you drinks. In fact, it literally says in verse 13, he satisfies you. When you're satisfied, okay, maybe it's okay. Maybe that's an area where you can really give God thanks. Maybe you take it for granted. You don't give him thanks in that. But what the text is going to reveal is God sending out all of these messengers. What's one of the messengers that he sends out? Refreshment? Satisfaction? That's a messenger of God. So the water comes down from the mountains. It satisfies. You go, okay, so how are you going to respond to God supplying all of your need? How are you going to respond to his refreshment and his kindness, his grace flowing down to the mountain? How do you respond to that? Well, it's a test. It's a test, as it were, to the hearts of men. And if you look at the next paragraph, he talks about the facts of the fact that he causes growth and the prosperity that God brings in your life. And, you know, sometimes people can handle difficulties better than they can handle prosperity. Some can't handle that too well. But prosperity is a test as well. So how do you handle that when God gives you an abundance and things begin to grow and wonderful things begin to sustain your heart and trees drink their fill? And there's interesting descriptions in which you see literally in nature God doing these things, and how nature responds, how do you respond, would be kind of the question. And so you come into verse 18 and you begin to see through 23 that, well, what else does God do? Well, he appoints times for things. Appoints time. That's interesting, isn't it? Not only does he cause seasons, but he establishes boundaries. In fact, if you back up into this, the beginning of the chapter, verse 5 through 9, you begin to see he established the earth, the foundations. Verse 9, he set a boundary. So God, well, there are limitations, there are boundaries, there's things that God establishes, appointments. Okay, so the question is, how do you handle that? These are all messengers that God sends. That's why the psalm starts off the way. God's sending out his messengers. What's he sending out his messengers to do? Test the hearts of men. To see what? To see if they're all in. How do we know that the Lord is doing that? Well, turn with me to 2 Chronicles. We'll just pick up in chapter 16. And most of you know this verse, but sometimes you don't have it marked down. So here it is. Here's your opportunity. Mark it, underline it, star it, circle it, whatever you do best. 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. And by the way, don't forget any of his benefits. Now don't be selective in this praise. Now, of course, James will tell us you should be even thankful for the trials, right? You should be giving him thanks for that. Don't leave anything out. You need to be all in. Why? Because those are the ones that God is looking for. Those, as we will go on to Psalm 105, will be the chosen ones. It's very interesting. So he's sending out messengers testing the hearts of men through all kinds of different venues as we come into Psalm 104. And not only does he talk about the appointments, but he talks about the fact of abundance. He talks about the fact of magnificence. You know, how do you handle all these things? And verse 27 through 30, literally, to me, if we were just to embrace 27 through 30, especially having to deal with, have you ever had to deal with death in your household? The fact that God takes away breath, and then he brings life into the world. You know, it's God that's doing this. How do you handle that? You know, the passage starts off, it says, they all wait for the Lord. I mean, there are certain things you can't do. You can't make happen. And man, when he feels so out of control, begins to get upset. God takes away a life, and man gets upset at God. How dare you do that? Of course, it's his breath. But God says, it's mine. He breathes. It's mine to give. He establishes all these things. How do you handle that? What is your soul saying? Are you saying, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that's within me? Are you giving him thanks for the benefits of his sovereign control over these areas of your life? It says in verse 32 that he touches the mountains and they get mad. That's an interesting picture, of course, of grandeur and pride lifted up. And, God begins to touch lives in certain ways, and they don't like the way that he's working in their lives. And so the proud have a tendency to get upset. But not us. In fact, what we're asking for, according to verse 34, is what? Let my meditation, look at the passage, be pleasing to you. As for me, I'll be glad in the Lord. So the difference between, we'll put it in the category, the difference between in Psalm, the sinners, which makes reference to the fact that somebody is rebelling against God, and those that are his chosen ones are fundamentally the saint gives praise to God in the midst of all of these things. Job will say, though you slay me, yet we're not talking to Job wasn't holy because he was perfect, even though he was the most righteous man in the faith. In fact, that got in the way. But what saved Job was his willingness to submit to God and then to ultimately say, it's all God, it's none of me. So the ultimate conclusion to Psalm 104 is that sinners are consumed really with their anger and their hostility towards God because God is doing things that they don't like. They don't like God taking control. They don't like the way that he works. They don't like the fact that maybe he's given success to this person or that person, and maybe not to themselves. They don't like the way the waters run. There's any multitude of things that we could conjure up in our mind why we would be upset at God. But the ultimate conclusion is, but not us. We just want to be pleasing to him, and whatever he's doing, we submit to. So there's a testing that's going on. God is trying the hearts of men. And in many respects, when you come to Psalm 105, we see kind of the conclusion of the testing that God chooses certain ones. And we're going to see Abraham listed, and we're going to see Isaac, and we're going to see Jacob, and we're going to see Joseph, and we're going to end this particular psalm as those that God chooses. And sometimes our thoughts are, well, why does he choose one and he doesn't choose another? Interesting, in Acts chapter 9, in verse 15, when Paul is, of course, he had that blindness as he's walking on the road to Damascus, and God stops him in his tracks. And the declaration to Paul was, you are chosen vessel of God's. That's quite a statement, because this is a guy that's been rebelling. This is a guy that's been ravaging the churches. And God says, you're my chosen vessel. So that Paul will actually say in 1 Timothy chapter 1, by the time you go down to verse 12, he'll say, the reason why God chose me, do you remember the reason? Because I was so wonderful. I was so wonderful. I was such a good student. Yeah, he was looking for an A-plus guy. You know. He acted in ignorance, but why did God choose him? Because he was faithful. He knew I was going to be faithful. That's a very interesting statement because one of the things that Paul says to Timothy is you need to teach faithful men who will be able to teach others also. In other words, there seems to be this quality of somebody that would embrace truth if, in fact, truth met them. John chapter 3 talks about the fact that one of the evidences that you are of God is that you come to the light. More specifically, light being a metaphor for truth. You come to the truth. And it shows that you have been wrought in God because of your desire for the truth. Or as Jesus will say to the woman at the well, my Father is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. And we chose you. Now, everything about this woman externally seems to say you got the wrong person. But as God says, as he's telling Samuel, you need to choose another guy because the Saul guy is not the guy. He says, because the problem is that man is looking at the outward appearance, and that's why they like this Saul. But I see this little shepherd boy, and I know there's nothing about him that's real impressive. But I see this boy's heart, and this is one faithful guy. This is one faithful guy. You remember Saul, when he was chosen, he's supposed to be watching his dad's herd, and of course, they start, where did they go? Where did they go? Oh, man, I lost him. David's still out there in the field when everybody's going to war. There's something about this guy's heart. Was he doing everything right? No. It wasn't about perfection, but what it was about was a heart. And God is looking, his eyes go all over the place, looking for somebody whose heart would be wholly his. And he finds a David, and David is all, there's one thing you can say about David, he's all in. Now when he messes up, he's all messed up. But he's all in, he jumps in. And you know that David has a heart for God. Not perfect. Any more than Abraham was perfect, any more than Jacob was perfect, and we're going to have some of these listed within the passage, but God is looking for those that are all in. So we start with Psalm 103. Now, he brings things into our lives to bring that out. And Judah's life is interesting because Judah doesn't appear initially to be that kind of person. And he literally helps with the process of selling his brother, Joseph, into slavery. But it will be Judah that will stand up and say, take me instead of Benjamin. And he'll stand up for his brother. And you'll go, that's a faithful heart. That's a faithful heart. What did it take to bring him there? Well, God sent out messengers. See, and God is sending out messengers in your life to do a sifting, to do a burning. His messengers, how's it described in Psalm 104? Are fire. So there's a burning. There's sometimes a refreshing with the rain, the clouds, part of his chariot. But the point is that they're going into all parts of the earth, and he's looking for those. And the things that happen in our life are for the purpose of bringing the genuine out of us. With Peter, there had to be such a sifting that he would have to deny Christ in order to come to the reality of what genuineness and faithfulness was really about. But he wanted that. There's no doubt that Peter wanted that. he was claiming things that he couldn't make happen. He couldn't have enough resolve. He couldn't be steadfast enough, but he longed for. And so the beginning of Psalm 105 is going to be about that. It's going to talk about those who are really seeking for these kind of things. And there are going to be basically three things that he mentions at the very start of this particular, one of the reasons why we're looking at this book, this chapter in a little bit more general sense is why. It's a big chapter. So, but if you look at the very beginning of the chapter, what you see is what God is calling us to do. Basically, there's three things that he's calling us to do. Give thanks, call on God, and make known his great deeds. So if you ever get confused, all right, now what am I supposed to do? I like it simple like that. So he starts off, oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among his people. I like that, don't you? I like just the simplicity of that. He established it right off the bat. Now, if you look in verse 2, someone's probably scratching their head going, okay, so how do you give thanks? He goes, well, sing. Why don't you can sing. You can sing it. And, of course, in the context, it's not only referencing to, you know, somebody singing, but somebody making it a melody of their heart. And, you know, once again, when you're dealing with music, it's stirring the emotions. And God is saying, mean it. When you give thanks, you ever prayed before a meal and you're really hungry, so you really wanted to make it short, and you really weren't thinking how thankful you were. There was really no melody there. There was no emotion in it. It was more a rote thing. God says, look, if you're going to give thanks, mean it. Let it be a joy of your heart. Let it be a melody within you. There's within my heart a melody. Jesus whispers sweet and low. Remember that song? Jesus, 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 sweetest name I know. It's a great passage, great song. So sing to him, sing praises to him. Speak of all his wonders. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. Did you give thanks of all the things that he's done for you? So many things, think about it, that we take for granted. I mean, in him we live and breathe and have our existence. What an amazing thing that is, that we take for granted. I think one of the things that my father's always helped me appreciate it is the beauty around me. He just stands back, he goes, have you ever thought why God went to all the trouble to put so much effort in this flower and in this flower? And how he makes everything so different. And there's a lot to give thanks for. The problem is that God is upset with man because, first of all, he doesn't acknowledge God, nor does he give thanks, Romans chapter 1. The wrath of God is revealed because you stop giving thanks. What has God called us to do? He's called us to give thanks. We're chosen for that purpose. He's looking for those hearts. Something happens to us we didn't like. It didn't fit into our paradigm. You forgot your calling, didn't you? Doesn't it say in Thessalonians that in everything give thanks? Doesn't it say in Philippians, rejoice always? Doesn't it say? I mean, it should be a part of our life. Everything should be. Of course, Colossians makes mention of the fact that you do everything, and he just adds, he keeps adding it at the end of almost every paragraph. Oh, yeah, and give thanks, and give thanks. So, yeah. Call upon his name. It's an interesting declaration, isn't it? When you have problems, who do you call? That's the question. Because we were actually called, we were chosen to call on him. One of the marks that makes us different, that makes us unique, everybody else is going to, people don't have Rolodex anymore. Everybody else is going through their, what do you call it?
Contactless.
Contactless, yeah, whatever. Everybody else is going through that. And what are you doing? Well, we're calling on the Lord. We're believing in him. Do you remember that 2 Chronicles 16 passage, Eyes of the Lord is searching? Do you remember what the context is? Do you remember a guy was sick? Okay. So Asa's having problems, physical problems. What is he not doing? He's not calling upon the Lord. Of course, before this, he was having soldier problems. He's having a war problems. And instead of calling upon the Lord, he went to another help for another nation. And now he's actually physically sick, his legs and his feet. And instead of calling on the Lord, he goes to the doctors. First thing, goes to the doctor. I'm not saying go to the doctor. I'm just saying, what do you do first? What do we do first? Who do we hope in? And God says, the person I'm looking for is somebody to call on me. Call on me. But that's one of the things that makes us different. I mean, the world is going, what are you, crazy? And we're saying, no different.
Wasn't he also angry at the person that gave him that little tidbit of verse of my eyes are searching, and he put that particular person that gave it to him in jail?
Well, I know he was hostile in his rebellion, that's for sure. And it just shows the heart of man and how unwilling we are to put all of our trust in him. But that's what makes us unique. And for a believer, we would rather do that than trust in man, right? Stop regarding man whose breath is in his nostrils. He can't even control his existence. Why are you trusting in him? So call upon him, his name, dealing with the fact that he's our Savior, he's a provider. His name really is the gamut of everything. Make known his deeds among his people, and of course that's the testimony that God has called us to do. What did Jesus say to his church there in Acts? He says, you shall be my witnesses, right? I mean, there's a reason he called his disciples. That's the reason he called prophets. We're here to bear testimony of the things that have happened within us, which means that you actually have to be somebody that gives thanks to the Lord, and you have to be somebody that calls upon him, and then you give testimony of the reality of God in your life. So clearly we have a summary at the very beginning of the book, and he says in verse 2, this is how you give praises. And if you look in verse 3, not only this is how you give praises, but this is how you call upon God. That's very interesting. So at the very beginning, he says, okay, how do you give thanks? Well, do this with all your heart. How do I call upon God? Well, if you look at the passage, verse 3, glory in his holy name, let the heart of those who seek the Lord. Okay, so when you're calling upon the Lord, who are you seeking? So you're seeking the Lord. And if you look, that's going to be a word that's repeated. In verse 4, seek the Lord and his strength. Once again, you see the word again? Seek his face, his favor. That's what seeking his face is. Seeking his favor continually. Is this pleasing to God? I want God's strength. I don't want man's strength. I want his favor. I don't want man's favor. And these are the things that I seek. Remember his wonders which he has done, his marvels and his judgments uttered by his mouth. O seed of Abraham, his servant. This is a perfect demonstration of faith. Abraham is that personification of faith. And so the passage is telling us that you and I have been called to put all of our trust in God, that Abraham would even hope against hope put his trust in God, which is once again reiterated in Romans chapter 4. O sons of Jacob, his chosen ones. That's a great, why would it say Jacob is chosen one? I think there's a couple reasons, actually a number of reasons why, but a few just stick out. One is if Jacob was going to be saved, he'd have to be chosen, because it wouldn't be through good works or anything that he had done. But, you know, once again, I think one of the things that Jacob reveals to us, and not to beat him up too much, but one of the things that Jacob reveals to us is a longing that goes beyond normal. I mean, he's going to wrestle with a divine being through the night. How many of you would do that? I mean, that's desire. That I want that blessing. And if you remember, verse 4 starts off what? Seek. Verse 3 ends, seek. And verse 4 ends, once again, with seek. So all the way through, there is that picture of those that have been, why would God choose this person? God has tested. He sent out his messengers, tested. And he says, I know the loyal hearts out there. I know that you don't recognize them, but I can see them. I can see them. And I found them, and I'm bringing them in. He describes them as the seed of Abraham, the sons of Jacob. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He's the one making decisions. I'm glad I don't know the hearts of men. And there have been so many times where I said, I don't think that's going to happen with that person. And God goes, well, watch me. You had no idea how much this person loves me. You had no idea how strong their heart was for me. And God begins to reveal that. When you come into verse 8 through 15, I think the key of this particular paragraph, and let me just say verses 1 through 7, we're identifying, I believe, the chosen ones, the ones that have been. Now, once again, you're coming out of Psalm 104, where the soul is being tried, being tested. The messengers of God are going out there. Psalm 103 is God's looking for somebody all in. So we know what he's looking for, and we know what he's doing. Now in Psalm 105, he's looking for those hearts that are all in that will do this. So he begins to identify them, and he gives these interesting pictures of Abraham and Jacob. But more specifically, he emphasizes that you'll know them by their seeking. You know, Scripture says, knock, and this will be open. Seek, and you shall find. So it's the people that are seeking for truth. It's the people that are seeking for God will come to the light. You got to have in your head that John 3. That's just a key passage. So verses 8 through 15 now begin to put us in the realm of relationship, covenant. And it all begins really with a promise. It begins with a commitment. It begins with, relationship. That it's impossible to be all in without a relationship. It's impossible. The question is, where does it all begin? I would say it begins with a commitment. It begins with a promise. But one of the reasons why we, you know, a couple says that they love each other, we bring them down at the altar and we have them say their vows to each other. What we say is that this relationship has to begin with a commitment. People go, it's just a piece of paper. It's not just a piece of paper. It's a declaration of a commitment. It's telling somebody, I am not going to leave you. We're in this. For better, for worse. Sickness and health, we're sticking together. This is a commitment that we're making with each other. See what I'm saying? So you're establishing the relationship, and the way that he puts it is, it's a covenant. Right? Now, so he'll use the word, verse 8, he has remembered his covenant, right? Look at verse 9. The covenant which he made with Abraham, an oath to Isaac. Verse 10, he confirmed it to Jacob, a statute, everlasting covenant, right? So what do you think we're talking about? Okay. So we're talking about a covenant here. And what we're talking about is a relationship that's based on this promise and this commitment to one another. And what's interesting is in verse 8, it starts off, he has remembered, probably a better way to put that is, he is ever mindful of his covenant with. If in fact you love somebody and you start going through difficult times together, it's always handy to have in mind, I made a commitment. I'm not leaving. Being ever mindful of that commitment. So it's that great covenant. And what's interesting is, in verse 8, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, which seems to be, he's talking about the different generations of the inhabitants of the whole earth, which seems to convey that God has not been shy about letting everybody know his intentions. You ask somebody, are you committed to this person? And they go something like, I don't know if I really want to say anything about it. Then you begin to wonder, okay, where was the commitment? But if you let everybody know, and then you let everybody know ahead of time, and I just want to let everybody know in the future, I'm going to be with them. So it's a great declaration, and it says, the covenant that he made with Abraham, which he begins to go into the realm of these personal relationships with individual. He could have said, you know, with the nation, with the peoples, with the... But it's all with individuals. He made a covenant with Abraham. He made an oath, an absolute guarantee, with Isaac. He turns to Isaac and he says, according to Genesis 26, he goes, I'm not leaving you guys. I'm going to stick with you guys. I'll be with you, and I'm going to bless your descendants. I'm sticking with you. So. All the way through, and then it says in verse 10, he confirmed it, see the passage, to Jacob for a statute. It seems as if God is saying, not only am I making a promise, as he did with Isaac, and not only am I making a covenant, as he did with Abraham, but he's actually using the word that is prescribing boundaries and specifics. And so in many respects, like with Jacob, he has 12 sons. So you go, so who exactly is this for? And he goes, let me give you specifics. It's for the 12 of your kids. And he lays it out in a boundary. You know, there's something about that boundary that says, okay, now you're getting specific. Now I know. You know, it's one thing to go around, whole world is blessed. Okay, that's interesting. But then God says, I'm going to bless you and everyone, and he begins to name everybody in your family. And those are the ones I'm going to bless. You go, okay, that's pretty specific. He goes, okay, solidify them. So saying, if you look in the passage, to you I will give the land of Canaan, it begins to talk about what he's going to give. He's given inheritance. And what's interesting is he describes them, and here's how he describes them. He describes them as few strangers and wandering. That's a great description, aren't you? God chose me. Why? Because you were few, you were very strange, and you didn't know where you're going. And that's why he chose you. I mean, it's that great picture of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. God chooses the weak and the foolish things, to confound the wise, the things that are not. But those are the ones that are what? Seeking. This is the key within the passage. Who are the ones that are seeking? Where does relationship go? How does it begin? And what the passage begins to reveal is that God makes this commitment to us. And we are drawn to him in the sense of, there's something inside of us that goes, why me? In every true believer, we are dumbfounded by, are you sure you got the right guy? Why me? And it's that sense of wonderment that creates a loyalty that goes beyond normal. We're just drawn to why would you die for me? Why would you make a covenant with me? Why would you do that? So, you know, could you say because I was so great? No, you were few in number. Could you say it was because you knew what you were doing and everybody likes you, you're very popular. No, you're a stranger. There's nothing about you. You don't know what's going on. You don't know where you're going. But that's why I called you. They wandered about, back at verse 12. When there were few men in number, very few strangers in it, and they wandered about from nation to nation, from one kingdom to the other people. And God, verse 14 and 15 says, and you want to know what I told those people? You can't touch my kids. So Abraham wanders off into the Pharaoh, or he wanders off into Abimelech, or Isaac wanders off to Abimelech. Or, you know, these guys are wandering all over the place. They're not real sure where they're going, what they're supposed to be doing. But no matter where they go, these pharaohs, these kings spit them out and go, let me give you some gifts as parting gifts when you go. And he gives them a bag of McDonald's and all kinds of stuff. So they don't have any needs at all. And you begin to see exponentially Abraham just getting richer and richer and richer. And you have to stand back and go, and he got rich because of mistakes? I mean, it's just nothing that, because he was wandering? Hebrew is literally a name that comes from wanderer. So he was a Hebrew. He was a wanderer. So the passage begins to talk about, if you look at the text, a covenant which begins the relationship. In other words, what God is looking for is this promise. He makes commitments. The Hebrews will say, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by his own name. He makes commitments. Every true relationship starts with a commitment. Every true relationship. That's why Romans 10, 9 and 10 says, you've got to confess them as Lord. Why do I have to confess them as Lord? Because you're making a commitment. You're making a commitment. You're saying he's the one that's going to be in charge of my life. Well, why is that important? Because you can't have a relationship without a commitment. It's impossible. So it starts off with this, verses 16 through 24. What do you think God is going to do? Refinement, right? Because ultimately the goal is for you to be a testimony, to make known his great workings. And this is an interesting picture. 16 through 24 is an interesting picture to me. I'm going to tell you why. Because I have seen it in households consistently. It's like God picks somebody out of the household and he goes, you're going to rescue that home. You know, pick another one out of this household. You're going to rescue that home. Picks another one out. You're going to rescue that home. You never know which one, but God sees the heart. And God says, now what we're going to do to begin with, I'm going to use you to help bring the home together, to save the loved ones. I'm going to use you. So he has a little conference, and here's the conference. But first, we're going to have to get you ready for it. We're going to have to prepare you. We're going to have to refine you. We're going to have to take off the rough edges, take out some of the bad stuff. Because quite frankly, you're a little bit arrogant. Well, I mean, you know, you start off young, you conquer the world. You don't know why everybody's so stupid. And finally, you go through life a little bit, and you become a little bit more thankful. And you begin to be a little bit more kind. I mean, it's amazing the changes and the transformations that happen through the refinement process. So who do you think God's going to choose? Well, Joseph, to save the family. And what do you think he's going to do? Well, he's going to lock him up. And he's going to put him in bondage, and he's going to be a slave, and he's going to eat some humble pie. But when he's all done, he's going to be perfect. He's going to be perfect. And he's going to start teaching his brother's wisdom. Now, everything that I told you is in this text, so let's read it. So he called for a famine in the land. Well, this is the beginning of the refinement process, right? It began the same way with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. He calls Abraham, and what's the first thing that happens? A famine in the land. So, verse 16, he called for a famine upon the land, and he broke the whole staff of bread, and he sent a man before them. I wonder who that is. Oh, that's right, the next phrase. Joseph, as a slave. Now, you remember Joseph when he was sold as a slave, was this young man in the field. He's telling on his brothers. He has a dream that his father tells him, don't tell anybody, but he's got to tell everybody how wonderful he is. And, so things aren't seemingly going well with him. So, sometimes God calls us out of a family, and we go, okay, all right, man, am I going to tell them what to do? I'm going to fix my family. You know, you've got it down pat. You know exactly what you're going to do because hey, you're the great one. You're the gotten one. And then God in his grace, what does he do? Yeah, things, humbling experiences, and you go, what did you call me for? To beat me up? And God says, this is no, I'm just preparation. Boot camp. So, he was sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet. Did you know that? They didn't actually record that. I don't remember. Do you? His feet being afflicted? If your feet are afflicted, you're not standing up. That's a humbling, isn't it? They afflicted his feet with fetters, and himself he was laid in irons. One of his great declarations was, you know, I'm going to be over everybody. And God goes, well, let's start with being under everybody. Until the time that his word came to pass, and the word of the Lord refined him, is actually the Hebrew word. Refined him. The king sent and released him. The rulers of the people set him free. Joseph is going to be freer than he's ever been before. Joseph is going to be wiser than he's ever been wise before. And Joseph is going to be more productive than he's ever been before. But it began with the refining process. So he made him lord of his house, ruler of all his possessions, to imprison his princes at will. One of the great passages there in Genesis is it says that God gave him the power to do whatever he wanted to do. And Pharaoh says, you know, I'm the Pharaoh. He says, but nobody's going to be able to do anything unless you give them word to do it. So now his brothers come in. You know, I get this sneaky suspicion that had he not gone through the slavery, the fetters, had he not been locked up in the irons, had the difficulty not come into his life, he would have handled this thing all wrong when his brothers came in. But instead of being oppressive, he does a testing. And instead of being condemning, he does a forgiveness. And God, if you look in the passage, he could have imprisoned them from then till kingdom come. But what he does is, and he does put him in prison for 3 days. But what he does do is he does what he does to what? Read with me verse 22. Why does he do what he do? Yeah. To teach him wisdom. And he brings out those qualities. You know, one of the first statements of his brothers were, we're honest men. Of course, we did lie about our brother. And when things started going bad, you know, they come before and they go, okay, God's punishing us for doing what we did to our brother, isn't he? He's punishing us. The elders are given wisdom, and Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham, and he caused his people to be what? very fruitful, and he made them stronger than their adversaries. The refinement process is going to make you stronger. It's going to make you more productive. It's going to make you wiser. The refining process is preparing you to rescue, which brings us into the next stage. So not only is this about a commitment, but it's about a refinement process. And the next stage is what? You got to get out. You got to get away. You got to be separated. You got to be freed from the things of the world. Something's going to happen in your life that causes you to say, I don't want to be here anymore. And sometimes, and this is the wisdom of God and the sovereignty of God, sometimes he causes the world to say that to you. This is what I think is extremely interesting about this paragraph, because God is saying, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the world to tell you, I don't want you in my neighborhood anymore. If you've ever felt despised and rejected, gee, that sounds a little bit like our Savior in Isaiah 53, doesn't it? If you ever felt despised and rejected, what do you think that is? What it is separation and release. It's God pushing you out. Do you know that God will sometimes cause somebody to hate you? Why, you know, David goes, why won't Saul love me? I don't understand. God goes, that's me. I don't want you trying to please Saul. I want you pleasing me. So sometimes God will push that. And listen, if you're not thinking right, if your heart's not right, if you're not seeking for the right things, you're going to perceive this as an attack by God. But it really is God releasing you from bad relationships. So how does it start off in verse 25? How does it start off? He turned their heart to hate his people. Very interesting. It's part of God moving us into the realm of ministry. And you and I can't seek the world. And we can't seek the favor of the world, and we can't seek the affirmation of the world, and we can't seek the things of the world. Now, as we go on, God will abundantly supply us with the things of the world. But these things cannot be and have a hold on us. And so the passage says he turned the heart to hate his people, to deal craftily with his servants. I mean, after a while, you're going, okay. I mean, look, the Israelites for about 400 years were starting to get pretty comfortable in this realm until God turned them to go, hey, you know, there's a lot of people. We could use them for slaves. Who thought about that? I don't know. But that began to happen, and then the Israelites go, okay, we used to like living here. Now we don't think we like you guys anymore. Of course, the Egyptians are going, I'm shocked. But what has to happen in order for us, for them to be released? Well, what has to happen is not only do the people have to see them as a commodity to oppress, but they have to see them as a problem to get rid of. So what do you think God's going to do? He's going to make them so miserable to have the Jews with them that they're going to throw them out. So, well, you know all the wondrous acts, right? He sent darkness, made it dark. He turned the waters into blood, verse 30. Frogs in the king's chambers. A swarm of flies, gnats. Boy, sand gnats. Oh, man. I don't know how those little creatures can make so miserable. We oftentimes laugh about the time we take a bunch of young people down camped out on the beach, and the sand gnats were terrible. I mean, nobody could sleep. Everybody was dancing around. We were jumping in the water. We were jumping out of the water. People were standing under these places of showers. We just said, get in the car. We're going home. Nobody stayed. But it's amazing. It's just a little, you can't even see them. And that's part of the problem, too. I mean, if you could see them, you could hit them or something, but you can't even see them. He gave them hail for rain, flaming fire in the land. He struck down their vines, the fig trees, shattered the trees of the territory. I mean, when are you going to get these guys out? He spoke the locusts. He spoke and the locusts came. I just see the locusts going, I think I hear someone calling. The locusts even without number, and they ate up all the vegetation of the land. They ate the fruit of the ground. He struck down the firstborn of the land, the first fruits of the vigor. By the way, verse 36, 37, 38, actually, this would go together. So I probably should have had that verse 38 here. That should be 38, and that'd be 39. Because I really believe, if you look at this, you'll see this. He brought them out with silver and gold among the tribes. There's not one who stumbled. Verse 38 just nails it. Doesn't verse 38 nail it? Egypt was glad to get rid of them. I can just see them. We'll pay you. No. Okay, just $20. No. More. We'll pay you more. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the dread of them had fallen upon them. It's a great passage. So what is God doing? Exactly what God's going to do in your life, what he's doing in my life. When you and I come to him, we start I make a commitment to God. I made a commitment to God. What does he do right after that? He starts refining you for the service because he's calling you to rescue people. And you've got to know how to do this. And you can't do this in a haphazard way, and you can't do it with a bad heart. And you can't do it with all the baggage that you have. God's going to use you. He's already chosen you to do this. Why did he choose me? He saw your heart. He saw somebody that was really seeking him with all of his heart. He knew this. So, you know, part of the process is refinement. The other part of the process is, you know, separation and getting out of there. And, you know, I think there's a point in your life in I would say there has to be a point in every true servant of God's life that he just says, I got to get out of here. And I truly believe this as well, that God causes the world to be so hostile towards. I mean, Jesus turns to his disciples, he goes, they hated me. What do you think is going to happen if you follow me? What do you think is going to happen? And it's part of the separation. It's part of the separation. Get out from among them and be separate. 2 Corinthians, right? So as you look at the end, verse 39 through 45, what do you think's happening? Well, what's happening is you're now coming into the possession and God supplying all of your needs. It kind of reminds me of, if you look at 2 Corinthians, just keep your finger here because we're going to jump right back. But 2 Corinthians, and if you drop it out of verse 9, you know the path. 2 Corinthians. Did I say 2 Corinthians?
Yes.
2 Corinthians 9. Drop on down to verse 6. It talks about he who sows sparingly shall reap sparingly. Drop on down. God's looking for a heart that's all in. That shouldn't surprise us. Verse 7. Now drop down to verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound to you so that always, having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. Well, up to this point, had you not gone through the refinement and separation, what would you have done with all of the benefits? You would have misused them or inappropriately used them. But now, he's going to start opening up the floodgates, and this is what you see in 39, 40, 41, 42, you know, God couldn't stop thinking about the promise that he made. This is what's been on God's heart all along. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a blessing. Isn't that what he says in verse 42? He remembered his holy words with Abraham, his servant. Wasn't that his commitment to Abraham? I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make you a blessing. So he gave them the lands of the nations. I like the way it's put in verse 44, that they might take possession of the fruit of other people's labor. How did I get all this stuff? They were working for you. It's like Ecclesiastes chapter 2. It says, you know, God gives and takes from other people that have worked really hard and labored all their life, and he gives it to people that he likes. That's how Ecclesiastes 2 ends. He gives to people he likes. People that he's happy with, he makes sure they get taken care of. I mean, it's so bizarre. You know, I've been around long enough to watch people get old. And you watch people get old that love God, and you see how they're taken care of. And you watch people get old that didn't love God, and no matter how much money they had, they end up with nothing. Abandoned. Lonely. Not taken care of. What you think money can buy somebody that really care for you? Don't be fooled. It's not healthy, nor is it care that the world is into. But anyway, so what you have is God giving all these things, and it says in verse 43, he brought forth his people with joy, his chosen ones with joyful shouting, and he gave them the lands of the nations. And why did he do this? Verse 45 is your key to the whole text. Because remember, you're giving thanks, you're calling upon God, so these are marks that distinguish us. But above all, we demonstrate our love for God by our testimony. And if you look specifically in verse 45, watch the way it reads, so that they might keep his statutes. Now, why would he use the word statutes here? Because statutes are referring to boundaries. Statutes are referring to boundaries, whether it be time, waiting on God, or whether it be positions, or whether it be things in your life, events. The man of God, the one that seeks God, will wait on him and will look for his limitations that he gives us, and we'll rejoice in that. We'll say, God, thank you. Thank you for telling me I can't go there. Thank you for the timing in my life. We'll give him praise for that, because that's what moves us. We believe that God is the one. We want to do things God's way. So everything that he's doing, we're reading, rather than us going to God and go, okay, I have an agenda here. I want to have done this or this, this, this. Then we start telling God, then we get mad at him because he's not, you know, he's not caving to our will. But that's not us. We're the people that keep his appointments, keep his timing, keep and maintain his boundaries. We observe these things. We stay. Keep means to stay. It means to be within the boundaries. It means to wait for. It means to observe the things that God is doing. All those things make reference to it. And observe his laws, his instruction, his direction, Torah, within the text. So I'm just waiting. It actually comes from a root word which means pointing. Yahweh. So what it's talking about is that what we're observing is, what's God pointing to? There are things in your life, and you just, all you have to do is look at his finger and you go, I know what you're getting at. And you know, I have a sneaky suspicion that Joseph learned a lot in that prison, and God began to point out certain things. And I remember, I bet Joseph was thinking in terms of, you know what? I should have kept my big mouth shut. I should have been more concerned for the relationship than I was concerned for my grandiosity. And you begin to learn things in those times, and that's what we do. That's what marks us out. But the one thing that just pulls us out from the bunch is we started with a whole heart. God says, I see that heart. He chooses us, and he takes us down this process. And what a great journey it is. But if you don't know where you're going, sometimes you can get, you almost get upset, And God goes, wait a minute, you're going to thank me and everything? This is why, you know, when you read, whether it's Peter or you read in James, he says, you ought to rejoice about this. Or Hebrews, it talks about discipline in chapter 12. You know, he goes, you ought to be thankful, because who the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he's directing you, and he must have you, he must be training you for a purpose. Because discipline is, the difference between discipline and punishment is, discipline always has a focus on training, where punishment is you getting what you deserve. So he's not giving us what we deserve. He's already stated that in Psalm 103. What he's doing is he's training us. And what a wonderful thing that is. Father, we give you thanks for the training that you give us and for the love that you have for us. And the fact that you would call us is just, it's just such an amazing thought to us. We give you thanks in Jesus' name.